And I guess what we will do next is we'll talk about the Torah portion. So join me if you will. If you got your Bibles handy, turn to the book of Exodus or Shemot. And tonight we're going to begin in chapter 6, not at the very beginning of chapter 6, but about two verses in. And this is the one that says, Vayera, and I appeared. This is the Almighty speaking. But I think it's interesting to note, too, that there is one other verse that kind of marks the demarcation line between this portion and then last week's portion, and I think it bears repeating. It's going to be repeated many, many times, but I certainly want to start that way tonight with this one. Chapter 6 is where Moshe is told, "Now you will see, you shall see what I will do to Pharaoh." And then he says, he spoke to Moshe and he said, "Ani Yahuwah." And if you're, I know I've had several folks say, "Well, yeah, I haven't had much experience with the Hebrew. Don't know much of the Hebrew." Well, that's one of the things we can work on a little bit. But this is an important one to learn. Ani literally just means I am. If I was to introduce myself to somebody in Jerusalem or on the streets or at a Hebrew class, I'd say Ani Mark, and that's what he says here. I am. I am who I say I am, Ani Yahuwah. And that gets repeated over and over and over again. And then he says this, and I appeared. Oh, there we go. There's Vayera. And he appeared, or and I appeared, unto Abraham, unto Isaac, and unto Yaakov, as El Shaddai. Let's see, no. This is, yeah, it is. It's El Shaddai. But by my name, Yod-Heh Vav-Heh, Yahuwah, I was not. I did not make myself known to them yet. And I've established my covenant with them to give them the land of Canaan. Just a second here. And I've established my covenant with them to give them the land of Canaan and the land of their sojournings, where they have sojourned. So, and also he says, I've heard the groanings of the children of Israel, whom the Egyptians have been keeping in bondage, and I have remembered. Zakar, that word there, the root of it, Zakar, is to call to mind. It's not so much as, you know, in the sense that he's forgotten, obviously, but in the sense that he has heard and he is now calling to mind. It's time, in other words, for the things that are fixing to happen here to happen. And then he says it again, verse 6. Therefore, I say unto the children of Israel, Ani Yahuwah, I will bring you out from under the burdens of the Egyptians. This is the famous set of I wills that you'll see talked about during the time of the Pesach at the Seder. I will bring you out from under the burdens of the Egyptians, and I will deliver you from their bondage, and I will redeem you with an outstretched arm and with great judgments, and I will take you to me for a people, and I will be to you Elohim, and you shall know that I am Ani Yahuwah, who brought you out from under the burdens of the Egyptians, and I'll bring you into the land that I lifted up my hand to give to Abraham, to Isaac, and to Jacob, and I'll give it to you for a heritage. Why? He says it again, Ani Yahuwah. Now, let's pause here for a second, because what you know is going to happen next. By the way, let me make this a regular announcement, as I always do. If there are questions, comments, we like to try to be as interactive as we can, given that there certainly is some teaching to go through. But when people have questions, because I know these are stories we've heard a lot of times, I'm going to try to hopefully point out a few of the real key elements, but still get through the essential gist of the story. But by all means, put the questions up on the screen, and if I miss them, put them up again. At the QQQ, capital Qs, in the line will help me to see them as well. But we'll get to them if we can. What we're going to see in this portion is the beginning of Moshe going to Pharaoh, doing the things that he has been told to do, and we're going to see the plagues, the famous plagues. And as we go through this, I'm going to outline a couple of kind of the major themes, things that I think are really important. Those of you that have been through the Torah cycle before have heard these before, but at least I find that every time I go through these things, I see more nuances. I see things that that I might not have seen before, or maybe I see them in a little bit different way. And especially, of course, as we watch things play out in the world around us and in the bondage of people who, a lot of times in America and the Western world, they don't even know the degree of the bondage that they're under. Remember, Pharaoh charged 20% to his slaves. He took their land, he took their bodies, he took their animals, and then he said, okay, you can live on the land. Literally, it's feudalism. And the fee will be 20%. You get to keep 80%. Hey, isn't that a lot mellower than what the IRS does? And that's not even counting all the other tax burdens. So when you actually look at it, people in America don't really, and of course that goes again for the whole Western world, they don't really understand. They look at the Egyptians and think, oh, that was a whole different deal. But ultimately, the similarities are bigger and more consistent than the differences are. So we got the story. We'll go through this part quickly. First, Yahuwah speaks to Moshe, and he says, go and talk to Pharaoh, king of Egypt, and tell him that he's to let the children of Israel go out of his land. And Moshe says to him, and we've kind of heard this before, behold, the children of Israel, they don't listen to me. Now, how's Pharaoh going to hear me, seeing that I have these uncircumcised lips? And then he gives to Moshe and unto Aaron a charge to bring out the children of Israel. He names the heads of the fathers' houses, sons of Reuben, sons of Simeon, and Levi, and so forth, all the way down through. Gives a little bit of the lineage, and even, interestingly enough, tells the lifespan of some of the folks, but not all of them, particularly of the sons of Levi. Levi lived 137 years, then Kohath and Uzziel. Kohath was 133 years old when he died. But doesn't give the ages of all of them. I always tend to think when I see numbers in Scripture that there's probably some additional nuance in there that one of these days we'll understand, but right now I got to admit, I don't. It came to pass, towards the end of chapter 6, on the day when Yahuwah spoke unto Moshe in the land of Mitzrayim, that's Egypt, for those of you that will get used to both of those words, but I actually like the way it's put in Scripture is Mitzrayim whenever it comes up. Yahuwah spoke unto Moshe, and he said, Ani Yahuwah, again. Ani Yahuwah, speak to Pharaoh, king of Egypt, everything that I'm telling you. And he says it again. Behold, I'm of uncircumcised lips. How is Pharaoh going to hearken to me? All right, let Aaron speak for you. All that that I speak and I command you, Aaron your brother will speak to Pharaoh, that he let the children of Israel go. Oh, by the way, he says in verse 3 here, I'm going to harden Pharaoh's heart and multiply my signs and my wonders in the land of Egypt. Now, this is one of the things that I'm going to spend some time as we go through it. We'll talk about, and I think there's so much about this story that's really interesting. You know, there's a bunch of questions you could ask, right? Here's the obvious one. If the whole goal is just to get the people of Israel out of bondage under Pharaoh, and he's the creator of the universe and author of all scripture and, you know, almighty and all powerful, why not just beam them out? Right? I mean, he could. Why not just beam them over to wherever he wants them to be and be done with it? We've already heard the answer, right? Ani Yahuwah. I am who I say I am. The point here is you're going to see this. The beginning of the portion, end of last week's portion, he just finished saying, Moshe, you're going to see this. Pharaoh is certainly going to see it. So what's the deal then about hardening Pharaoh's heart? He could quash Pharaoh like a bug, right? Why do that either? That's a little bit more interesting story. And as we go through this, I hopefully we'll shed some more light on that as well. Now, there's one other thing that I think probably most of you here have heard, but there may be some folks that haven't yet as well. Why 10 plagues? Some folks will divide it into three sets of three plus one. In other words, there's three plagues that have similarities. We got kind of three sets of three plagues. Oh, and then we got this last one that's very different, the death of the firstborn. So we got 10 plagues total. Why 10? What's the message there? Well, one of the most obvious ones I'll suggest is this. Pharaoh was considered to be a god. He saw himself that way. He's not alone among kings and emperors and presidents and other would-be potentates and dictators who all seem to have that kind of common character flaw, as they see themselves as the lawgiver and the lawtaker and the lawmaker and the Elohim of whatever it is that they survey. But moreover, Egypt itself, Mitzrayim, is a very pagan land. They got gods for everything. And unlike the one creator of the universe, who literally has authority over all of the things that this pantheon of the gods of Egypt claimed little bits of authority over, I think what we're going to see happen here is, one by one by one, these supposed gods, and I'm going to be a little flippant here towards them, just like he was. There's an old Hebrew saying, man plans and God laughs. And I think in this case, you actually see some of the humor flowing through. You see some of the sarcasm, some of the things, and we'll point that out too as we go through this, that Elohim Yod-Heh-Vav-Heh does to literally humiliate the so-called gods of Mitzrayim. It's like he holds them up one by one by one and says, you think this is a god? Let me show you something real here, folks. Ani Yahuwah. I am who I say I am. Now you'll know it. I mentioned the thing about hardening Pharaoh's heart. And I'm going to suggest this up front, too. There are two different terms. Now, in the King James, you don't see this. This is yet another one of those good places where I think it's always worth pointing out that if you look in the original Hebrew, sometimes the translators do as good of a job as they can. But ultimately, when it talks about the Pharaoh's heart, or lev, there's kind of two ways that can be phrased. And one of the ways has to do with stubbornness, that kind of hard-heartedness. And then the other way, some of you all remember the word kazakh. It's a commandment given to a number of people, notably Joshua. Be strong and of good... I like it. It's great. It's a great word. And essentially what it means is to be strengthened. What is a strong-hearted person? Well, that's courageous. And you'll see that both terms are used as we go through these plagues. Pharaoh's heart is hardened. Sometimes he hardens it himself. You could argue that's the stubborn side, but it's not always completely consistent that way. Sometimes his heart is hardened, and it means that he acts more courageously. He has the strength of his convictions, rightly or wrongly. So back to verse 4. What's that? Do I have a question? Okay, I missed a question. Oh, 10 commandments, 10 plagues?
No, QQQ, any relation to uncircumcised lips and circumcising Moses' son and
support
being married?
Well, I would probably so. Yeah, the question is there any relationship between the uncircumcised lips and uncircumcised Moses' son? Zipporah had to do that. And that's why she called, you're a bloody husband to me, and threw the foreskin at his feet. When you see that word, you would tend to think so. But I guess, as far as, do I have any additional insight that I can lay into that right now? Possibly not. If anything, it's Moshe just, I don't know that he's even being modest. I think in this case, he's probably still in the mode of shrinking a little bit from the task. He uses the word, I'm sure it's probably, it rings close to home. But for now, I guess that's all I would have to add on that one. We do see one other thing in here that I think is interesting, and I guess this kind of ties in just a little bit anyway. When we talk about Moshe and the fact that he does become a leader of men, arguably one of the foremost, if not the foremost, in history. And that is that Moshe, it says here in verse 7, was 80 years old. A score is 20 years. So he was 80 years old when he and Aaron was 43. He was 3 years older than his younger brother, when they went and spoke unto Pharaoh. So you can literally divide Moshe's life up into three-thirds, if you will. First third, he's raised in the house of Pharaoh. Learns about Egyptian culture, Egyptian gods, certainly a little bit about his own heritage as well. And then the second, third, interestingly enough, he goes out in the wilderness. He learns to tend sheep. He spends 40 years learning how to tend sheep. We're going to talk about that, but it seems that that's important. And if you recognize the biblical metaphor, I guess if there's any surprise there, it's in the length of time that it takes somebody to become a really good sheep herder and to learn what he needs to learn. You know, hey, couldn't he have done that in 5 years? I guess not. Okay, so there's a question about his own rod or Moshe's rod. And I don't think we know the answer to that one, because we'll have to look at the Hebrew text when we get there. From Dodia, question: about turning into a crocodile as opposed to a nachash. He was going to kill Moshe, but that was last week's Torah portion, Connie, having to do with Moshe's son. And I guess I didn't give a very good answer last week either, because it's pretty. It doesn't give us a lot of background in Scripture. So I got several questions on the field. I'll try to remember the one about his rod when we get to that point too. We know that the first one was for sure Moshe's rod, and if I had to guess, I would think that that's what's being referred to, is Moses' rod in this case. He does it, and Aaron talks about it. Aaron's the spokesperson. And we're gonna see that briefly here. When Pharaoh speaks to you saying, show us a wonder, here's what you're going to do. You're going to take your rod, right? Now, whose rod? He's talking to Moshe. So, it does not explicitly say take Moses' rod, but the way I read it in context, that would be what it is. So it's Moshe's rod, it would seem to be, that's cast down before Pharaoh becomes a serpent. So they went in, they do exactly what they're doing. Now, at this point, though, it says Aaron cast down his rod. So I see part of the reason for the potential confusion. And it became a serpent. Now, let me check here. I don't see Nakash in there. So that word I'll have to look up. So maybe it is a crocodile, but I don't have my online dictionary here. Sorry about that. I'm striking out tonight, guys. Apologize for that. In terms of questions that I hadn't thought through, just because for the most part, as you're going to see, I want to make sure we emphasize a couple of other things too. One of these other themes is coming up next. Moshe, after this happens, Pharaoh calls for his own wise men and his sorcerers. And they too, the magicians of Egypt, or Mitzrayim, they did in like manner with their secret arts. Now there's an old saying, some of you may have heard it, it's attributed to Arthur C. Clarke, a science fiction author, and he says, any sufficiently advanced technology is indistinguishable from magic. In other words, there's this question. Oh, these are secret arts. Is it technology that they're using here? We're not told. Here's another question that we could ask that I wouldn't be able to give you a good answer to. But I have a suspicion that there are some things that they, one way or the other, have learned and are keeping secret. They managed to duplicate this feat. And the fact that they can do it, at least for a while, is a big deal. Tends to kind of make them think, well, this isn't such a big deal. And you turned your rod into a serpent? Well, so can we. But then we get to verse 12. They cast down these magicians, these sorcerers, their own rods. They became serpents. And now it does say Aaron's rod, right? Aaron's rod swallowed up their rod. So, yeah, I stand corrected. Pharaoh's heart was hardened. Pharaoh sees this. He hardens his own heart. That would be the implication. Pharaoh's heart was hardened. He didn't listen to them, just as had been foretold, just as Yod-Heh-Vav-Heh had spoken. Now, here's where I want to start and take a peek at some of these Hebrew words. Pharaoh's heart was hardened. And in the Hebrew there, it says, le yat. This is hard for me to pronounce. It's the word that essentially is is kazak, and the form of the word, that same root word here, is yechzak. Yechzak. Hardened. Basically, his heart was strong. At least that's his perspective on it. And so he didn't do what he was asked to do. But it's interesting. The very next verse, verse 14, we're going to do this compare and contrast thing here more than once tonight. Yahuwah then said unto Moshe, Pharaoh's heart is stubborn. He refuses to let the people go. And the word there for his lev, his heart, so what you see is this. The word that is used by the creator of the universe is kabed. Kabed. For not a strong heart so much as a stubborn heart. Both of them can be rendered in some versions as hard-hearted. But the difference is key. Pharaoh sees it as, I'm being firm here, courageous, strong-hearted. And Yod-Heh-Vav-Heh says to Moshe, he's stubborn. And that distinction is key. So he tells him what to tell him. Yahuwah, the Elohim of the Hebrews, sent me to you, saying, let my people go. They can serve me in the wilderness, and you haven't listened. So, behold, you're going to know that I am Yahuwah, Ani Yahuwah. I will smite the rod that's in my hand upon the waters which are in the river. They will be turned into blood. So this, if you will, is the first of the plagues. First plague, right? Turning the River Nile into blood. Now, the River Nile, if you think about it, is one of the foremost gods. Why? Well, because the Nile is the thing that irrigates their crops. Without the river and the Nile, they die. The Nile is literally the source of all the things that that nourish that entire delta there, the Nile Delta area. It's very, very important. You know, in terms of the gods, if you think about it this way, the first and the last of the plagues arguably are against some of the most important of the various Egyptian or Mitraite gods. Water. What's the last one? The plague of darkness. Well, it shuts off the sun. Sun god, Ra, big deal. Almost like bookends. But there's one more. There's one more issue here too. And I'm going to turn to another commentary for that one, because I think this is a very interesting way of looking at it as well. Somebody asked earlier about the Ten Commandments, and I don't know. Certainly what you do see is you see that the numbers are the same, but I don't think there's a direct one-to-one correspondence, obviously. But there are some other one-to-one correspondences. One of those is going to be this one. Take a look at these first two plagues. They both, in one way or another, refer back to the beginning of the Egyptian or the Mitzrayite persecution of the B'nai Israel, the children of Israel. What was the first thing that we saw happen as this story opens? The killing of the male children at birth. And they tried to do it two different ways. First, it was through the midwives. But remember, we have Shifra and Puah. They were named specifically. They refused to obey. They failed the Romans 13 test. They would not listen to their king. His plan didn't succeed. But he wasn't done yet. He tried another way. Remember how? By throwing the children into the Nile River to drown. Using the river that literally brings life in the form of fertilizing the crops to bring death to the Hebrew male children. So I'm looking at a midrash. This is by a fellow that I like, Rabbi Lord Jonathan Sachs. It seems like of all the guys that I read, I seem to most relate to his take on some things. And he says, now understand, this is why in that first plague it's the river and the waters that turn to blood. Because of this connection with life and blood and the killing of the firstborn male children. And, oh, by the way, the significance of the second of the plagues, the frogs, we're going to talk about that in a minute here, would have been immediately apparent to the Egyptians, too, because they had a frog goddess whose name was Hecht. And she was really closely associated with this idea of midwifery, assisting women in labor. So essentially what this is a set of coded messages that are telling these people, again, like I said, in one respect, you think this is a god? I'll show you a real god. But more specifically, look, what have you done here? You have used the river, the Nile, and the midwives both things that are normally associated with life, instead of using these things as they should be used to bring life, you have used them to bring death. And guess what? Measure for measure is kind of the Hebrew concept that's associated with this. These same forces are going to turn against you. In other words, says the rabbi here, reality has an ethical structure. If it is used for evil ends, eventually these powers of nature, their gods that they see as harnessed, will turn against man. What he does will be done in turn to him. And I find that to be an interesting message in the first couple of plagues. We're going to see a lot of parallels, a lot of things like that when it comes to these gods. Okay, back to the story here. So we've got Pharaoh's heart. We're going to come back to this idea of Pharaoh's heart. He sees it as strong, courageous, and Yod-Heh-Vav-Heh says, no, he's being stubborn. So now the river turns to blood, the fish in the river die, the river becomes foul, and the Egyptians, they're not particularly anxious to drink from it anymore. And he says to Aaron, take your rod, I'm going to assume this is Aaron's rod again, since he's talking to Aaron, and stretch out your hand over the waters of Mitzrayim, the rest of the waters, over the rivers, over the streams, over the pools, over the ponds, and they too will become blood. There'll be blood throughout the land of Egypt, all the vessels of wood and the vessels of stone. And Moshe and Aaron did as they were commanded as by Yahuwah. And he lifted up the rod, he smote the rivers, and in the sight of his servants, all the waters in the river were turned to blood. The fish died, the water stank, the Egyptians couldn't drink from it, and there was blood throughout all the land of Egypt. Now, once again, we see this pattern, at least for a while. Here come the magicians. Can we do the same thing? Oh, yeah, yeah, we can do this. We got twos. We'll see if it's just temporary for a second. Okay, hopefully it's better now. Good. Can the magicians do the same thing? Yeah. Now, you thought that was nasty? The water stinks? Hey, we can make water stink, too. Now, think about it, folks. Making water stink is probably not the toughest thing. We do it all the time. And the magicians did like, and Pharaoh's heart was hardened. And in this sense, too, it's ve-yach-zak. Recognize that? That's the kazak root again, strengthened. He didn't listen to them. He turned and went into his house. And the Egyptians, they dug around, they looked for water, they couldn't find anything. Then we got 7 days that are fulfilled. Moshe is told, go into Pharaoh. Say to him again, let my people go, that they may serve me. And if you don't, he's told, behold, I will smite all your borders with frogs, with zephardim. And the river swarms with frogs. Now, this is always in the Midrash, you get all kinds of interesting stuff. I guess we don't have time to talk. Occasionally I'll see some things that I see in the teachings, and I think, wow, that's really stretching it. Essentially, one of the Midrash Shem that I read this week had to do with the fact that the frogs were commanded. We see this in verse 28. The river swarms with frogs. Some of the teachings even say there was one frog and he got smitten, and then he multiplied into more frogs, and they started smashing those frogs, and they multiplied too. You know, where some of this stuff comes from, I'm not sure. I know it's part of the oral tradition, and there are things that people have written about for years. To some extent, it's almost just amusing. But it does say this, the frogs are going to come into your house, into your bedchamber, on your bed, in the house of your servants, upon thy people, into your ovens, and into your kneading troughs, upon thee, your people, and all your servants. Sounds fairly gnarly. And essentially, one of the Midrashim actually talks about, you know, the frogs are going to be all over the place, but some of the brave frogs are going to be the ones that go into the ovens to fulfill the commandment here.
Have you lost?
Uh-oh.
I lost Pal Talk.
I think we lost Pal Talk. I did.
Mm-hmm.
So we're still live on... did you lose Pal Talk too? Savior.
I did.
Okay. I'm going to exit Pal Talk. We'll give us just a second here, folks. We'll have to do some reconnection. If you're listening on the direct talking Torah line. It'd probably take about a minute for Pal Talk to come back up again. I hope it'll come up in a minute. There we go. Okay, let's try it again. Okay, let's try it again. Okay. Uh-oh.
You did another weird thing, too.
It's not supposed to do that. We got the feedback loop. But I think we got all that taken care of now. Sorry for the interruption. Yeah, you know, sometimes I think, well, when I'm saying this, it's really going to rile the NSA listeners up. But I don't know that that would have been as likely to upset them. What I'm fixing to say might. Chapter 8. We're well into the second plague here. Now, stretch forth your hand, he says to Aaron, or your rod over the rivers, canals, pools. Frogs are going to come up. He did so. The frogs came up. They covered the land. Now we got the magicians one more time. They did in like manner with their secret arts, their high tech. And they, too, brought up frogs. Hey, we don't have enough frogs. You know, this is almost funny in a way. We, too, can make our lives even more miserable. It's not enough that we got frogs in our beds and on our ovens and all over the place. No, no, we want some more frogs. We got more humor of frogs coming up in a minute. Pharaoh calls for Moshe and Aaron. And he says, entreat Yod-Heh-Vav-Heh, that he take away the frogs from me and from my people, and I will let the people go, that they may sacrifice to Yahuwah. Now, it sounds like he's caving a bit here, right? Moshe then says to Pharaoh the following. Now, this is another one of those things that there's been lots made about. I do tend to go with Rashi on this one, because it seems that there's more at play here than meets the eye. What he says is this. Moshe says to Pharaoh, against what time shall I entreat thee and for your servants and for your people that the frogs be destroyed from you and your houses and then remain only in the place where they belong, in the river? Now, Rashi points out that in this verse here, it says, le mati. And that the prefix, the le, is key. Because essentially what he's saying is, look, if you want to think of it in the English, I'm going to pray now. Right now I'm going to pray for the frogs to be gone. But when do you want me to pray that the frogs are gone? Now you would think, and this herein lies some of the claims and the interesting thought experiment that goes along with this, you would think that the obvious answer would be, for crying out loud, let's get them gone now. There's a song and a lot of teachings, and it's almost a joke. It's kind of funny. That comes out of this. It's called One More Night with the Frogs. You know, I'm thinking maybe one more night. Let's not get rid of the frogs tonight. Let's go for tomorrow morning. I like the slimy frogs in my bedchambers and my ovens. What is going on with that, right? Well, the common story is something like this, that Pharaoh here is trying to play a game. Maybe the magicians have come to him and said, okay, look, here's how this is working, Pharaoh. There's some kind of natural sequence that's happening. We don't know exactly what it is yet, but Moshe just merely knows that the frogs were coming, you see. And he knows the frogs are leaving almost immediately. So maybe we'll play this trick on him. At least that's how the story goes. So Pharaoh says, it's worth to me one more night with the frogs in order to find out. I'll trip Moshe up. He thinks I'm going to ask for him to be gone immediately. I'm gonna fox him. I'm going to tell him tomorrow morning. Now, this is, by the way, where we see a little bit more humor coming in from the Almighty, too. So that's the answer that he gives Moshe. Pharaoh says, against tomorrow. And Moses' response, well, be it according to your word, so that you may know there is no one like unto Yahuwah, our God. Yahuwah Eloheinu. The frogs will depart from you and your houses of people only in the river. And he did. He did what he asked, and Yod-Heh-Vav-Heh did what Moshe asked. The frogs died out of the houses, the courts, and out of the fields. I started, when we got cut off, I was almost joking a little bit about one of the Midrash I talked about the brave frogs that knew that they were supposed to go all these places, and the bravest frogs were the ones that voluntarily jumped into the ovens. And it says in verse 9 that all the other frogs died out of the houses, courts, and out of the fields, but the frogs that were in the ovens, they must have been preserved because of their bravery. All right, I'm not necessarily buying it. I'm certainly not going to talk about that too much other than to say, you know, there's probably plenty of humor in here without having to add to it a whole lot anyway. The land stank. They gathered together in heaps. But when Pharaoh saw that there was respite, he hardened his own heart. And in this case, the word that is used there is kebed. That's the stubbornness kind of a word. He hardened his heart in a very stubborn fashion. That's the more typical one. And he didn't listen. He didn't obey, just as Yod-Heh-Vav-Heh spoken. So now we get to the third plague. Was there one other comment I wanted to make out about the frogs? Yeah, there is, but we'll come to it in just a second. Remember what Pharaoh said? Tomorrow. I think we'll have the frogs gone tomorrow. Bear that in mind for a second. So now, here comes Yod-Heh-Vav-Heh, says to Moshe, and say to Aaron, stretch out your rod, smite the dust of the earth, so that it may become gnats. Le-kenim. Throughout all the land of Egypt. Now, there's some dispute about what that word in the Hebrew actually means. Is it properly translated gnats, or is it beasts? I kind of go with gnats. Some say with lice, kin. It's not 100% clear. The thing about the gnats or the lice that seems to be, you know, by the way, and what are gnats and lice but just little teeny beasts? And they're really, really beasty if you got billions and billions of the things. They did so. Aaron stretches out his hand, he smote the dust of the earth, and there were gnats, lots and lots of gnats upon man and beast, and the dust of the earth, all of it, became gnats throughout all of Mitzrayim. Now we got the plot thickens and changes just a little bit here. The magicians. We don't have enough gnats. No, let's have a few billions more. They did so with their secret arts, and they tried. They genuinely wanted more gnats, but they couldn't do it. They failed. There were gnats upon man and upon beast anyway, though. And then the magicians, they finally begin to see it. Now, I mentioned the Arthur Clarke thing. Any sufficiently advanced technology indistinguishable from magic? Think about this just for a second. What convinces the magicians? What convinces us, by the way, that something is a miracle as opposed to, well, just high-tech? As long as we can explain it, we're willing to say it's not God. There's a certain consistency in that, and I think that's essentially what the sci-fi guys are saying, too. Look, if we have the technology for this, and we can explain it with our technology, or at least rationalize it, well, you see, it had to be an earthquake that caused the Red Sea to part at the proper time. Therefore, we know what it is, so it couldn't have been God. And the magicians, at this point, are trying to bring forth gnats. They couldn't. Uh-oh. This is the finger of God, they say. And they tell Pharaoh that. Let's pause for a second. I see the question. I'm not sure exactly chiggers equals lice equals gnats. Could be. I'm sure these were nasty little buggers and that there were lots of them. Beyond that, again, this is one of several places where we just plain don't completely understand, so as near as I can tell, the exact meaning of the original Hebrew word, and any of those are probably close enough. By the way, for those of you that haven't been in Missouri, chiggers bite. You'll see them down south. You won't see them, actually. You go down to Belize or to Costa Rica, to the Caribbean coasts and places where they have these little things they call no-see-ems, because they're so small you can't see them. So I don't know any of these. We could be talking any of those in this particular case. But again, I think the most important aspect of this is it's the fact that the magicians, at this point, they're checking out. This is the finger of God. So what happens? Now Pharaoh is on his own, right? Look, my team of experts has just bailed on me. And they're saying this is the finger of God. So now what? Verse 15 says, Pharaoh's heart was hardened. It's the chazak form again. Yechetzach. His lev, his heart. He didn't listen, as Yahuwah had spoken. The reason why that word in this case is the chazak, the strong part, as opposed to the stubborn part, is, I think, pretty well explained by the differences in those words. What does it take? Now, yeah, you could say he's stubborn all the time, but in this case, his magicians have bailed. So this is strength of conviction, if you will. This is the strong heart, kind of the positive side of it, in a way. He's wrong. It's going to cost him a whole lot, as we see through the rest of the story. But hey, he's sticking by his guns. It's not just that he's stubborn. Now he's on his own, and he's still being, if you will, strong-hearted. Now we got to verse 16 here. And then Yahuwah says to Moshe, "Rise up early in the morning." Huh? In the morning? Isn't that funny? Yahuwah says to Moshe, "Rise up early in the morning. Stand before Pharaoh, comes to the water, and say to him, let my people go, that they may serve me again. Else, if you will not let my people go, I'll send swarms, this time of flies, upon you, and upon your servants, your people, all your houses will be full of flies." And now we're going to see some things really begin to change. Okay. Let's see how we're doing. We pause again. Everybody back with us? Got some solid ones again? Two kind of things on the table that are interesting. What we're going to see here is a whole lot of stuff happens tomorrow. And in a lot of the subsequent cases, Moshe says, "Oh, this is going to happen tomorrow. This is going to happen tomorrow." Do you notice? It's a little bit like, look, you're playing this game with me, telling me I'm willing to spend one more night with the frogs, tomorrow? Oh, okay. Well, now the plagues, I'm going to tell you about them today, they'll start tomorrow. See, we can play this game too. The God of the universe, I guess, is not mocked. He has a better sense of humor than your team does. But there's one other thing that is different about the flies. Now, we've just had the magicians basically begin to part company. This is the hand of God, they say. What's the next thing that happens? Here come the flies tomorrow, and I'm going to set apart in that day the land of Goshen, says Yod-Heh-Vav-Heh, where my people dwell. No flies there, so that you may know. See, it's not just that I can do this tomorrow. It's not just that your magicians have figured it out. It's that I can separate my own people. They've been suffering for a while, and they had to deal with the frogs. But they're not going to have to deal with the flies. I will put, says verse 19, and I'm going to suggest this to you folks, when we look ahead and we see the things that are coming, because I firmly believe that there'll come a time when we will see a judgment against the gods of America. Obamacare, the modern medical miracle, that we don't need Yahuwah Rapha anymore, we got the medical pharmacopoeia miracle. That's a god, isn't it? How about the almighty dollar? That would probably qualify as a god. Maybe there's some other ones. You know, I don't know whether it's Hollywood. The point is, we'll have a chance to figure out which are the 10 that are going to be held up one by one and probably ridiculed and cast down. But it's comforting, I think, to look at verse 19 and realize that I guess the almighty dollar, that's a plague on all of us as it collapses. We're seeing that. But there will come a point at which he will say, "I will put a division between my people and your people." tomorrow. By tomorrow, this sign will be. So he did so. Lots of flies in the house of Pharaoh, his servants' houses. All the land of Egypt was ruined by reason of the swarms of flies. And Moshe, now, and Aaron get the call. Pharaoh says, go, 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 sacrifice to your Elohim in the land. And now Moshe changes things just a bit. He says, it's not meet to do so. We sacrifice the abomination of the Mitraites, the Egyptians, to Yahuwah Eloheinu. And if we do that, won't they stone us? So we'll go 3 days journey in the wilderness and sacrifice to Yahuwah Eloheinu as he commands us. Not as you command us, Pharaoh. I'll let you go, says Pharaoh. You may sacrifice him. I'll just don't go very far away. Now we're dickering. Remember this, the sequence, denial, anger, dickering, all of those sequences of things that are difficult. Question on the screen. Do you think we'll know? This one for the Egyptians, but not for us. Yeah, I think we will, because I think that he tells us. He'll let us know. I'll put a division. He gave them fair warning. And, you know, I don't know if they tuned into the TV and got the word that Moses said today in a meeting with Pharaoh that he would not bring the sins of, you know, I don't know how it'll play out. But one way or the other, yeah, I think we'll probably be able to know these things. And matter of fact, if I had to guess, and we look at the bookends thing, this is the, we got gnats, number three. And now, number four, flies. That's where we see the change. So maybe we'll get it about the fourth plague. Maybe it's the seventh plague from the other end, counting the other way. We'll find out. The dickering goes on. Moshe says, I'll go out from you. I'll entreat Yahuwah. The swarms of flies may depart. Only, don't be so deceiving, Pharaoh, anymore in not letting the people go out. Moshe entreated Yahuwah, and he did, according to the word of Moshe, removing the swarms of flies from all of these places. Not one remained. But what do we see again? Pharaoh hardens his own heart. What is the phrase that is used here? It's ve-yek-bed, same root, the kebed root, meaning stubbornness. This time he was stubborn. I mean, he's just finished basically lying. He keeps changing his mind. Last chapter, we're going to see just a few more things begin to pan out here. And I want to talk about one more major theme as we get into this last chapter. Go on to Pharaoh, Moshe is told this time. Tell him, here, this is what Yod-Heh-Vav-Heh says, the God of the Hebrews. Let my people go that they may serve me. If you refuse, if you still hold on to them, behold, the hand of Yahuwah will come upon the cattle, the horses, the asses, the camels, herds, flocks. It's going to be a nasty situation. And, once again, Yahuwah shall make a division. Not only the people here, but their animals as well. Their animals will be separated from the animals of Mitzrayim. Nothing will die at all of those that belong to the B'nai Israel. And when are we going to do this? Hey, are you with me yet, Pharaoh? Tomorrow. Tomorrow we'll do this thing. And he did that thing on the morrow. All the cattle of Egypt died, but the cattle of Israel, not one of them passes away. Pharaoh saw, behold, not one cow dead or anything else among the Israelites. But the heart of Pharaoh, guess which one it is here? Still kebed, stubborn. He's not going to let them go. Now, Yahuwah says unto Moshe, get some handfuls of soot out of the furnace. Throw it heavenward in the sight of Pharaoh. It's going to become dust, and it'll be boils breaking forth, blains upon man and beast throughout all the land of Egypt. They took the soot, they stood before Pharaoh, they throw it up in the air, boils break out all over the place. And the magicians, at this point, now, you got to figure, they've already said, this is the hand of Yah, there's some things we haven't been able to do. Now we're starting to see these divisions being made between, you know, those folks in the land of Goshen and the rest of us. We're not liking this one bit. And now, the boils are breaking forth upon them. They couldn't stand before Moshe, because the boils were upon the magicians and upon all the Egyptians. The magicians have seen it. They've already seen it, and you got to figure at this point they're not liking it at all. And now we see a real big change. We've been working up to this with this difference between Chabad and Chazak. Because in this case, verse 12 says, it is Yahuwah for the first time. And Yod-Heh-Vav-Heh hardened the heart of Pharaoh. What do you think he did to his heart? Did he make it stubborn? No, Pharaoh had done that pretty well on his own. He strengthened the heart of Pharaoh, the Chazak root here. Pharaoh, basically, at this point, you know, you could say he's made his bed, he's going to lie in it. But literally, in a sense, and this is where we kind of put this last theme together. I started this whole thing out by saying, why not just beam them out? We're not done with the plagues yet. There's going to be some more things to follow in next week's portion. We'll kind of leave this as a cliffhanger. But what we do see is there's a bigger lesson that's at play here. A, we've already talked about the various gods that are being held up and dissed one after another. You think this is a god? Hardly. I will be glorified. I will show by my mighty hand. Ani Yahuwah. It's all about the creator of the universe. And it's all about him giving Pharaoh chance after chance, and the people of Israel, and the magicians, and the others, to see and to acknowledge who he is and what he's doing. We know that the end of the story tells us there's a mixed multitude. I bet you a lot of these magicians, folks, were among those that said, you know what? Hey, when's the bus leaving, Moshe? I want to be on it. That they go with the children of Israel. They're later grafted in because they see it. So the opportunity here is for all who will to recognize the truth, get away from the false gods, go with the real one. Yeah, over and over again, there's this consistent theme. I'm separating my people from these other ones. I'm giving you every opportunity to realize you can't do this stuff. This is the creator of the universe. These are false gods. Your technology ain't up to it. And now it's Pharaoh's heart that is hardened by Yod-Heh-Vav-Heh, strengthened. Because at this point, he's if you think about it, he's kind of going it alone. He's still got to have people that are going to obey his commands. But the magicians have already said, we see it. Okay, we got a question. The children of Israel were subject to the first three plagues. Will this be a repeat? Not subject to the rest of the plagues. And that's essentially kind of what I've been alluding to, Snake Stomper. I see that as a parallel, yeah. Can I say, thus speaks Yod-Heh-Vav-Heh? Well, not exactly. So to some extent, what you're hearing is markology, if you will. I see the pattern in the scripture here. And I think we're going to see very, very similar, maybe bookend kind of patterns play out. And when I say bookends, that means, you know, the first three plagues visited upon everybody, the last seven not. Well, if it's a mirror image bookend, that means maybe we got to deal with seven plagues and the last three not. See, I'm not sure. I'm guessing, though. I'm just guessing in the way that I connect the dots that if it's a repeating pattern, well, then we got three plagues to deal with. We're out off the hook for the last seven, at least if we will walk in obedience, stay in the house, do the things we're told to do. By the way, the magicians and others start to listen to Moshe about this time, right? So the point is, learn the patterns now, and no matter what we do, let's do the very best we can to stay in the house and to stay on the right team and recognize the creator of the universe and go with him rather than with those who are on the Pharaoh, Emperor, Big Brother, you name it side. Hopefully, so everybody seeing the hard hardening thing? The question always comes down to free will, right? Does Pharaoh have free will? Well, he did. He's executed it. He's exercised it over and over and over again. He's made his choice. And at this point, see, it's not stubbornness that brings him into this. This is essentially the creator of the universe literally strengthening his conviction so that he can follow through on a choice that he's already made. Connie says something I think is interesting, that this pattern of plagues might be so complex we couldn't even identify one, two, or three. I'm not sure I believe that. I think when it comes time for the creator of the universe... Now, remember, the magicians, they weren't willing to recognize these things were real for a while. We can do this too. We can make blood. We can make frogs. But eventually they figure it out. So you're right. There'll be those without eyes to see that'll be blind. They won't catch it. They'll say, "Well, this isn't God. This is just natural. This isn't God that's destroyed the almighty dollar. This is just economics, or this is just a failure of the almighty Ben, or the almighty Janet Yellen." They'll have plenty of explanations for a while, but for those with eyes to see, I think it'll be a little bit more clear. That's just me, though. Yahuwah, now he says unto Moshe, this is going to sound familiar again, rise up early in the morning, stand before Pharaoh, let my people go that they may serve me, for I will this time send all my plagues upon, it says in the King James-ish version here I'm looking at, upon your person, and upon your servants, and upon your people. But you know what? That's not the word in the Hebrew, folks. It says, I will this time send all my plagues upon your heart. The same heart that he just hardened, strengthened. I'm going to send all my plagues upon your heart, your servants, and your people. You may know that there is no one like me in all the earth. Surely, now, I put my hand forth, I've smitten you and your people with pestilence, you've been cut off, but in this very deed, for this cause, I've made you stand. See? I strengthened your heart. The heart that I'm going to now bring plagues upon, to show you my power, my name made to be declared throughout all the earth. Ani Yahuwah. And if you exalt yourself, you hubris-filled, stubborn guy, you, against my people, and you will not let them go, behold, he's going to rub his nose in it one more time. Behold, tomorrow, hey, you get it, Pharaoh? Isn't this funny? Tomorrow I will cause it to rain with a very grievous hail, such as has not been seen in Egypt in Mitzrayim since the day it was founded, not until now. Now let's pause. We'll pause at verse 19, because I got a question or two on the screen. Did Yah poison the Pacific Ocean? And I like the line from Torah student. He surely allowed it to happen. This is the magicians, if you will. We can poison waters, and they did. Is that the first plague? I don't know. I think we got other plagues. It might be that there are more dramatic ones to come. We'll talk in the news about some other plagues that are already coming, by the way, too. But this plague here, the last one that we're going to talk about tonight, is interesting because we're seeing this, I don't like the word evolution, but this change that is taking place. And we begin to see it big time in verse 19. Now, he says, send, hasten, put your cattle indoors for crying out loud. Everything you have in the field, every man and beast that's out in the field is getting fixed to be whacked. Anything that's not brought home, the hail will come down upon them and they shall die. What does verse 20 tell us? You know what? By this time, there's a lot of people in Mitzrayim that are listening. Moshe again issued a warning today saying that if you don't get indoors, it's going to be ugly out there. The magicians, I'm betting, and probably a whole lot of other people are starting to say, you know, I think we better pay attention to that guy. We called him a conspiracy theorist for a long time. Didn't believe he was a true, harbinger or true prophet of the Almighty Yah, but we're starting to get the message. So verse 20 says, he that feared the word of Yahuwah among the servants of Pharaoh did what they were told. They brought their servants and their cattle into the house. But he that didn't listen left them outdoors. Guess what happened to him? Yahuwah said unto Moshe, stretch forth your hand, that there is hail in all the land of Egypt, upon man and upon beast, every herb of the field throughout the land. And Moshe stretched forth his rod, thunder and hail come, fire rains down upon... Wait a second. Whoa, time out here. This is interesting, isn't it? This is unlike any hail we've ever seen before. We got thunder and hail. Okay, we've seen that. Maybe it's really, really big hail. But the fire, for crying out loud, how often do you see ice and fire raining down at the same time from the sky? Yahuwah caused hail of ice and fire upon the land of Egypt. So, verse 24 says the following, there was hail and fire flashing up amidst the hail, very grievous, such as had never been seen in the land of Mitzrayim since it became a nation. Now here we pause again, because there are two separate gods, little g, Elohim, that the Egyptians worshipped that were associated with, well, you know, like a hail god, the storm god, and you got this ice god and this fire god. But guess what? They don't like each other. How often do you see fire and ice hanging out together, buddying up? Well, the point is, so far as the Midrash is concerned, and I think this is a really excellent point, this makes an impression upon Pharaoh. This is the first time we see Pharaoh really, like his own magicians, starting to say, whoa, time out. Now, I've seen a lot of stuff. My magicians are pretty sharp. They couldn't make the lice, but now I got hail and ice together. The hail smites everything that was out in the outdoors, broke every tree. Only in the land of Goshen, of course, where the children of Israel were, there was no hail. Moses and Aaron get the call from Pharaoh again, and he says to them, listen to this. I have sinned this time. Yahuwah is righteous. Me and my people, we are the wicked ones. So ask him, please. Let there be enough of these mighty thunderings of hail. I'll let you go. You will stay no longer. Whoa, he's changed his mind. As soon as I'm gone out of the city, I'll spread forth my hand, the thunder will cease, neither will there be any more hail, that you may know that Ha'aretz, the earth, is Yahuwah's. But as for you and your servants, I know that you are not yet quite on board. You will not yet fear Yahuwah Eloheka. And the flax and barley were smitten, and the wheat and the spelt, well, they survive because they ripen later on. Moses goes out of the city, he spreads forth his hand, and behold, the thunders and the hail cease, the rain was not poured upon the earth. And as we wrap up last couple verses of the portion for tonight, I want to point out again, imagine this, those same words appear. We got Pharaoh, hard-hearted Pharaoh, and it says the same English words in verse 34 and 35. Would it surprise you to know that they're two different Hebrew words? Pharaoh saw, it says, that the rain and the hail and the thunders were ceased. Surprise, surprise. He sinned yet more. He hardened his own heart, he and his servants. Want to guess which word is used there? Yeah, it's the kabad. The stubbornness word. Pharaoh made himself stubborn. He's just finished sinning. He makes himself stubborn. And then the heart of Pharaoh, it says, was hardened. And in this case, now all of a sudden it's the other one. I'm going to suggest to you, when I look at this and when I compare it to the ones we just did, the chapter 7, verses 13 and 14, you notice that the order is reversed. Pharaoh saw himself the first time as strong-hearted and courageous, standing up against this Yahuwah. I know him not. And the creator of the universe says, he's just being stubborn. He's just kabed. But now, Pharaoh strengthens. No, he doesn't. His heart is stubborn. But the heart of Pharaoh was hardened. It was made strong. Looks to me like it's the creator of the universe, when we do the comparison and contrasting, that is going on here. He's being strengthened once again. He has sinned. He's stubborn. But he's going to go with it. He's going to stick with it. He didn't let the children of Israel go, just as Yod-Heh-Vav-Heh had spoken by Moshe. Once again, we're seeing that the things that are happening here over and over again are he is sticking by his word. He is showing himself strong. And it really does boil down to, they will know, Ani Yahuwah. So as we wrap up that, I guess that's kind of the two-word summary of the whole portion. Ani Yahuwah. They will know it. Pharaoh, because he's been first stubborn and now has a strong heart, has been strengthened by Yod-Heh-Vav-Heh to follow through to the bitter end of this thing. The magicians, a lot of other people in Mitzrayim are beginning to figure it out. They're seeing the distinction that has been made in these plagues, and they're also beginning to say, okay, look, we can't do this. We can't explain this. This really does look like it's the finger of Yod-Heh-Vav-Heh that is at work here. We're going to start listening. This guy Moshe speaks, we're gonna start listening to him. It all points to one thing. It all points to the creator of the universe, Ani Yahuwah. He is who he says he is. All right, we pause there. That was all I intended to say, but got the question from Jack and Jay, chapter 318. Moshe said, let my people go. Was it to worship Yah and come back? This is another one of those things where there's lots and lots of discussion in the Midrash, and we could probably talk about it for an hour. Was Moshe lying? What was the intention here? And the analysts will have parsed this one about six different ways to Sunday. Was he lying or was he exaggerating? We've talked about that kind of thing before. Did he intend to come back? He never said specifically they were going to come back, but he kind of implied it, right? So that seems to be the way that the most of the sages break this down as well. He certainly could argue that since the intent really was to keep my people free, that he was woofing the Pharaoh just a bit. Wasn't being quite straight with him. But on the other hand, neither was Pharaoh. In other words, there's a negotiation here. Nobody's quite playing straight. And, of course, the creator of the universe knew what was going to happen all along. He knew that Pharaoh was going to lie. He knew that he was going to have his heart first hardened by himself, and then it was going to have to be strengthened so that he would follow through to the bitter end. So I guess the answer is kind of all of the above on that score. There's even those that say, well, look, here's part of the difference is in the land, there's a higher standard of truth that's required. And they're not in the land yet. They're getting there. I'm not quite sure if I completely buy that, but it's another way of looking at these same things. But you're right, at least, to point out what seems obvious there. The discussion centers on letting my people go. And it does not. It's the request is silent. They talk about 3 days' journey. But if you parse it like a lawyer, in other words, it's silent about whether they ever intend to come back or not. And then as we get to the end of the story next week, we're going to see that, well, once those 3 days are up and Pharaoh realizes, well, they're not coming back. They don't intend to come back. Well, his heart's already hardened anyway. Now we're going to go out after him. Okay, any other questions, comments? Did I miss any? If I did, if there's something, I know occasionally I do miss some. So if somebody has one that I didn't get to, just put a cue up or something like that and let me know, and then you can type or copy it. Otherwise, what we will do is we'll have another song. I guess we got time during the song to do this too. And then we'll talk about the plagues that are descending upon the land, this land, not to be confused with that land, in a minute.
You are Lord of creation and Lord of my life, Lord of the land and the sea. You were Lord of the heavens before there was time, and Lord of all lords you will be. We bow down and we worship Yahweh, we bow down and we worship Yahweh, we bow down. We worship Yahweh, King of all kings you will be. You are King of creation and King of my life, King of the land and the sea. You were King of the heavens before there was time, and King of all kings you will be. We bow down and we worship Yahweh, we bow down and we worship Yahweh, we bow down and we worship Yahweh, King of all kings you will be.
Lord,
Lord of all lords you will be, King of all kings you will be.
Okay, well, let's talk about the fake Elohim running around in America today. I mentioned this last week. I'm going to just quickly follow up on it because there was some discussion, as you might suspect, earlier in the week. The Fed, that would be the unconstitutional public-private partnership, this mixture that is neither constitutional nor lawful, nor does it deal with honest money or anything else, was 100 years old on the 23rd of December. December the 13th, or 23rd, 1913 was when the creature from Jekyll Island was birthed in secret and signed into what laughably is called law. Here's the funny story from this week. This came out because PBS promised a debate on Friday. And they were going to talk about, on the 100th birthday of the Fed, the benefits and the dangers of the Federal Reserve. And they had two famous stock market historians that were billed to be debating the issue. Now, one of them is Jim Grant. James Grant, who has Grant's Interest Rate Observer. And I'm pleased to say, many years ago at IBM Boulder, I worked with Jim Grant before he went on to be a famous Fed watcher and bond prognosticator. He's a sharp guy. I always liked Jim. He was put up against a fella named, what's the other guy's name? Richard Silla of the NYU Stern School of Business and the Henry Kaufman Professor of History. And essentially, the opening scene for the program shows Silla in a party hat lighting candles on the Fed's birthday cake, and then Grant comes in and snuffs them out, suggesting at least that Silla would be the pro-Fed statement kind of guy, and Grant, to at least not to my surprise, would take the opposing view. He's not a Fed fan. And here's what's funny, folks. When it was all said and done, there was no debate. They both agreed that the Fed was an abomination. Grant said this, new thing, the Fed has moved into the business of talking up the stock market. The Fed is manipulating prices, especially on Wall Street. Then to another question from the moderator, Consuelo Mack, his Wealth Track program, Grant says, the Fed has presided over the decay of finance. You tell him, Jim. Professor Silla added more fuel to the fire. Rather than disagreeing, he said, the Fed seems to have, I think, almost deliberately. It's trying to push the stock market up. I've watched this stuff for 40, 50 years now, and this is the first time in my memory when it seemed to be official U.S. government policy that the market goes up. And the Fed likes this because it thinks that when the market goes up, people who own stocks feel richer, they'll go out and spend more money, and unemployment will come down. So, the funny thing was the PBS debate between the pro-Fed and anti-Fed folks, both of them turned out to be Fed bashing and talking about how what the Fed has been reduced to now is just a stock market pimp. But it may not be all it's cracked up to. Got a question. Obamacare allows the establishment of demitude and the Sharia Muslim diktat. Exceptions for Muslims. Well, I guess I won't comment on that a whole lot other than to say essentially what Obamacare is doing, in the modern context, it's setting up another god. We don't need Yahuwah Rapha to be our healer. We don't even give you slaves a choice. Remember, it used to be that Americans thought they were a free people. But you even had the Supreme Court saying, hey, if you're a tax slave, why, you don't have any choice. For the first time, we can dictate to you what you will buy. And by the way, Obamacare is going to dictate to you that when we say bend over and take an injection, you're going to take it, right? We'll come back to some of that this week. So there are exemptions for all kinds of people, not just various kinds of Muslim stuff. Essentially, when the law is no longer what's written, but what the emperor or the pharaoh or the king says it is, it's no longer law. It's diktat. Fiat. A lot like the money. But the fiat's breaking down. This was the other economic piece, back on that score. Some of you know that one of the things that is kind of the most followed interest rate is what's called the U.S. 10-year Treasury note. And for a long time, and I've even got a story here, which I probably won't have time to go through, from Jim Willie saying, hey, everybody knows 3%, 3.000% is kind of the line in the sand. As long as the Fed can keep a lid on bond prices and prevent them from collapsing to the point where the interest rate goes above 3%, they can claim at least that they got things under control. Well, guess what? Today, folks, the U.S. 10-year note went above 3%. As a matter of fact, it went to 3.019%. I didn't see the end of the day. It may have gone higher. But that was the highest since July of 2011 while they were driving it down. Again, not a good thing. On that news, even the manipulated gold and silver markets jumped up. They were above their two critical numbers, $1,200 for gold and $20 for silver, and that's even in the manipulated markets. And the West Texas Intermediate crude, the U.S. benchmark crude price, broke through $100 a barrel. Keep your cars full, I guess, is part of it. The gold situation continues to deteriorate. This one's almost funny. In India, if you have been out of the country for long enough, it's kind of like the U.S. You know, you can carry $10,000, they say, which doesn't buy anywhere close to what it used to when that rule was put in place. Hasn't been changed for inflation, obviously. Anyway, Indians want to import gold, but they're prohibited, and it's really difficult to import gold. Except that, this is a story from Michael Krieger. The drug smuggling in India has gone up by 7 times. I mentioned this in a recent week, and it's now surpassing the illegal drug trade. But there was a flight that came up earlier this week, came from Dubai to Calcutta. And when the people got off and declared what they had on them, almost every single passenger on board, and there were 80-some of them on this particular plane, every single one of them had 1 kilo, which is the maximum amount they could carry, on their person. A kilo of gold, folks, is 2.54 pounds. That's over 30 ounces, and that's well over $35,000 worth of gold, and every single person on board had one of those. Now, one of the funny things was, it turns out, somebody was wise to this. The smugglers were actually lining people up and saying, look, if you'll take this kilo of gold through to the other side, we'll pay for your tickets. Now, I would have called that a free market at one point. You do something for me, I'll make it worth your while. You want a free ticket? There you go. But the Indians are complaining, at least the Indian price suppressors are complaining. Hey, I'm not supposed to do that. Well, they were just obeying the rules as you guys keep changing them. Another thing out of India this week, Bitcoin. They don't want any other alternatives. In other words, what these stories show is it's all about capital controls. We've talked about this before. When countries get in trouble, they want to prevent the slaves from being able to move their money. Let my people go? Well, you may be able to go, but you can't take any money with you. And so not only are they clamping down on gold and trying to prevent people from bringing it in or out, but don't worry, people aren't taking it out. They want it there. Now they've tried to clamp down on Bitcoin as well, and not deliberately. They basically just caution citizens that it may be illegal. This is how it's done. It's called fear, uncertainty, and doubt. Did they ban, or did they just kind of sort of ban it? One more funny story on the economic front. This from the Washington Examiner, kind of a mainstream publication, and a top financial advisor that consults for all of his own clients, a Wall Street expert, and a financial advisor and contributor to Forbes magazine, David John Murata is his name, came out and he put together a list of things people need to be aware of, and he said this in a note to his investors. Firearms are the last thing on his list. He suggests people put together a bug-out bag and that they be ready just in case the you-know-what hits the fan. He said Americans should have a survival kit just to take along in case there's a financial or natural disaster, something that'll keep them alive for the first 3 days, 72 hours of a crisis. And the list includes firearms. Bug-out bag, he said, is a good idea. Even if the emergency is just power outages, earthquakes, or hurricanes, be prepared, especially if it helps you from being scared. And on the list, he says, there are firearms. They may be the last item on his list, but they are on the list. There are some terrible people in this world, he said, and you feel safer when your trusted neighbor has firearms. It's funny to me that the Waste Stream is even reporting that here you got your Wall Street experts not only even admitting, now he had the usual disclaimers, my clients are concerned, there's a possibility of a precipitous decline, although I think it's more likely to be long and drawn out malaise that brings down the dollar. But he says, while he doesn't buy the end-of-the-world scenario, he admits it as a possibility, and that, it's prudent to be prepared. Amazing stuff. The panic begins. Some of you may have heard the Xmas season wasn't quite what it was cracked up to be when it comes to retailers, and there was a schism, huge split between what was the hope and the reality. And the National Retail Federation predicted that Xmas season sales would be up by almost 4%. 3.9% was the prediction. When all was said and done, oops, missed it. It was instead not up at all. It was down by 3.5%. And this week, the after Christmas sales begin. The only people that seem to be celebrating is UPS and FedEx, because it turns out that something like 33% or so of all of the online sales, not to mention the in-store sales, may be getting returned. And there was one interesting factoid that I saw in an article on this same subject. A fellow pointed out, look, people aren't stupid. If the average person sees their health care rise as a result of the Obamacare abomination, just $100 a month, and that's probably conservative, per capita, You multiply that out, that's almost $72.25 billion less discretionary income as a result of that one thing alone. And what he says is don't hold your breath. You look at numbers like that, there's not going to be a retail recovery. And people like Richard Russell and a whole lot of others are saying, yeah, things are really getting ugly. Look at the price of gold. He expects that we will see not, as has happened before, another devaluation of the dollar against gold. And I mentioned Willie, and Willie has a lot more interesting stuff to say. What I'll probably do is talk about that in some more detail tomorrow, because we just plain don't have time on this one to go through that in the detail that it deserves. But basically, the wheels are coming off the economic wagon, and all of these things we're talking about are indicators. They just show how close that is. It's kind of like saying tomorrow this plague will come. Duck Dynasty, yeah, it's almost like the what was the name of the network? I don't watch them. Arts and Entertainment Network, A&E, backed off just as the Cracker Barrel chain backed off. He didn't back down, and they did. And I think it had to do with the fact that a whole lot of people decided they weren't going to watch the network anymore. And they made that very clear. The battle, in other words, has been joined, I guess is one way to put it. And I find that encouraging. Not that a lot of people have quite figured out all the details yet, but the first step in turning around is at least recognizing that you're going the wrong way. Now, here's the other story that I want to make sure we mention. This came up last week, too. I even had some questions on it. I know that some of the folks that are on board with us here that are from the South, from Texas, probably are more familiar with it than some of the stories. But it turns out that there's a whole lot of, shall we say, buzz about H1N1, a flu virus that is going around. And it's maybe a modified H1N1 flu virus. Now, you may know that the H1N1 is also called, among others, it's called swine flu. I find that interesting, right? If you will do, says Yod Heh Vav Heh, the things that I tell you to do, don't eat the things that aren't food that I tell you not to eat, like pigs and shellfish and other non-food things, well, then I'll bring none of the diseases that I brought upon Israel. I'm sorry, upon Egypt. Later Israel, because Israel didn't listen. And indeed, they did suffer those plagues. In the strongest possible terms, and I think probably almost everybody here has heard this, this isn't going to surprise folks, but I think it is important we point this out to our loved ones. If you have never decided yet that just maybe it's a good time to go back, read Scripture, teshuvah, repent, turn around and quit eating crap that is not food? Are you eating swine? It's poison. Literally, it's not food. People are going to die. People are already dying. There have been a number of deaths in Texas, and indeed all over the South. There are three states besides Texas. I got the list in here somewhere. Influenza-like illnesses in Louisiana, Mississippi, and Alabama as well. They're all rated 10 on a scale of 1 to 10. And the question is, of course, is this natural a virus, or as some of us suspect, maybe it's genetically modified, bioengineered into a weaponized form. It's entirely possible. There's a lot of people in Texas that are concerned, saying that, A, the tests, the rapid tests that we've been using, aren't very good. They're not identifying this thing. And, B, they're calling it, in some cases, a mystery illness, saying it doesn't quite fit the pattern. Don't know what's going on. But I'll suggest the one pattern that does matter is, if you want to be blessed, if you want to walk in his blessing and his protection, Yahuwah Rapha, and not suffer the diseases, the plagues of Mitzrayim, and that were later visited upon all those other nations, that including Israel, both northern and southern kingdoms, that were rebellious to him, well then, listen. You know, pull out the owner's manual, read what it says there. You don't put sugar in your gas tank, and you shouldn't be putting pork in your tummy. Because it ain't food. And the same thing goes for shellfish. If that wasn't obvious, it's gotten to the point, of course, where your protein oil don't want to eat anything that comes out of the Pacific. But know, at least, that the things that the Creator put there to be the scavengers, the bottom feeders, the lobsters, the oysters, the shellfish, well, one of the things that anybody will tell you that understands how this biosystem works is those things are the death eaters. Pigs eat dead stuff. They begin the recycling process. So do lobsters and shrimp and shellfish. They eat dead stuff. And guess what? When there's heavy metals or mercury that shows up in the water, that's the first thing I'll tell you. It's all in the shellfish. Why? Well, because that's what they're for. And the same thing goes for radioactive particles and stuff. You know, they'll trip the Geiger counter first. Well, this week we're seeing that new model shows not only, you know, do you not want to be eating stuff out of the Pacific, but it turns out that a fellow named Arne Gunderson, who's been a consultant talking about the continuing debacle that is Fukushima, was that the authorities, particularly in the Seattle area, they knew darn well that there was radiation coming across, and they got new models now saying it happened sooner and it was worse, and that the officials had helicopters up, they had measuring devices 90 days after Fukushima, and they claimed national security, and they didn't tell people. And all that it would have taken was for people in Seattle, for example, to wear air masks. Instead, now it's stuck in their lungs. He said the average person probably ingested 10 what they call hot particles a day for a period of time. And they will cause problems. It's sad. It's disgusting. What I'm trying to do is make the point here with several of these stories that you look at the Food and Drug Administration and the Department of Agriculture. Hey, did you know that 50% of the chicken in the United States is infected with superbug-resistant bacteria? Oh, and it may be causing problems with people's immune system. I mean, all of this basically says, look, Pharaoh's been lying. They don't have your best interests at heart. They're not protecting the food. They are putting genetically modified crap in there. It does cause problems. And there's a whole lot of other stuff going on that just simply says, if you will listen to me, I'll keep you healthy and safe. But instead, if you will turn to the prince of this world and listen to his people, it's going to be ugly. Now, here's one more story. This comes out of Israel, interestingly enough. And the Business Insider reports that the former head of security at an Israeli airport, a fellow named Rafi Sela, was dissing the Transportation Sexual Abuse Agency earlier. He said it was all bull. Beep! And, quote, the TSA couldn't protect you from a six-year-old with a water balloon, unquote. He had some other nice things to say about TSA as well. But it's interesting, again, to see people pointing out, look, they're telling you, they're protecting you. Don't kid yourself. It's all security theater. We'll end with this one. And we'll, by the way, if you've got prayer requests, praise reports, anything like that, put those up. I mentioned the Jim Willie story. I'll talk about that tomorrow. He talks at some length in a really wonderful piece here about the continuing deceptions in the economic sphere of how it all melts down. And not only that, but when you look at economics, it includes some of the things that are going on in the Mideast, the realignments there that we've talked about of the Saudis and the war on Syria and a number of things. Again, he looks at it from an economic perspective. He calls it the fascist business model that the banksters are putting in place. Of course, Scripture tells us, follow the money. Well, what it says is the love of money, or of fake money, I guess, in particular, that abomination, is the root of all evil. And a fellow named Dave Hodges does something called the Common Sense Show. Dave Hodges, for those of you that don't know him, is kind of in the same camp, I think, with people like Steve Quayle and the Hageman brothers and some others. Fairly high profile. Definitely what you would call, I wouldn't call them. The mainstream media would call them conspiracy theorists. That way they can diss them and say that you don't have to pay attention to them. But in any case, it seems like Hodges has some pretty good connections. He and some of these other folks have people that come to them and give them information. Now, you have to be careful when you look at this information, because there are people that will come and bring disinformation. I've seen that a lot of times, too. You know, the Bible says, let everything be confirmed in the mouth of two or three witnesses. So we don't, even if people come and we think we know them, I can think of a number of examples. I won't go through all the names, but essentially good people, hearts in the right place, that have been fed disinformation deliberately. And I don't doubt that that's a common practice. It's a spy versus spy. It's part of the way that the world works. Just know that people will lie. I mean, you don't have to watch, NCIS or any of those other shows to say, oh, our allies will feed us disinformation too. It's part of Sun Tzu and the Art of War. Anyway, Hodges had an interesting piece this week. He made a couple of what I would call very significant claims, and there's some new ones coming. I'm not going to go through this whole piece, but I'm just going to point some of these things out as we look at the plagues that are coming, and ask some questions. He believes, and I'm not going to disagree with this, that there are people. Sometimes they're called the globalists, you know, that the real conspiracy types will talk about the Illuminati or, you know, who knows, pick a villain. I'm a little bit more simple-minded, perhaps. I'd say, look, ultimately, we know there is, in fact, a force for evil in the world. And whether there's a cabal of international banksters that gets together in a smoke-filled room and, does satanic worship rites or not, I don't know for sure. I have my doubts that, some of what I've seen could very well be the case. But I do know that by their fruit, we can tell they're all serving the same master. And it really is ultimately that simple. And what they're doing is they're putting together a dictatorship. You could call it the New World Order if you want. There are people that are obviously needing to be destroyed so far as they're concerned. The slaves. They're looking to establish absolute control. They're putting together a police state. And he says this. His sources have told him, A, some things that have happened. This is interesting. I'm gonna mention a couple of things. Again, understand, I can't prove this. He'll tell you he can't prove it. But it certainly begins to make pieces fit together. And I'm not going to deny that it's a good possibility. He says this. Obama's clearly between a rock and a hard place. And he believes, and he has sources that will claim, and I've actually said this prior to the fact. I said, well, hey, you know, when you see the meltdown coming, know that there'll be a war quickly. Why didn't we get the economic meltdown? Well, because we didn't get the war. Remember when we were, you know, this close to going to war with Syria? We had the false flag of the alleged chemical weapons that turned out to be given by the Saudi prince Bandar to the supposed good guys, the U.S. al-Qaeda forces, the Syrian rebels. I mean, talk about spy versus spy, and everybody's lying. Well, anyway, they couldn't get the war precipitated. And here's the rest of the story, says Dave Hodges. Obama was unable to launch the petrodollar rescue mission that included invading Syria and then Iran because he was outmaneuvered by Putin. And he has 5 impeachable offenses, i.e. Benghazi, Fast and Furious, everybody knows them, that will not go away, and that what is now happening is an in-process mutiny against Obama. You saw the first volleys fired. Remember General Hamm? He was the former head of AFRICOM. He was fired because he tried to rescue the ambassador to Libya, Stevens, who was being executed along with some of the special forces folks. There was a general in charge of the fleet that was literally hung out to dry, too. It turns out, he says, the assassination of Stevens has been a turning point in the relationship of Obama with the military. Obama's beginning to realize he cannot count on a majority of the military to carry out his unconstitutional, you know, suppression of the American people. So this is the claim. He says there are many sources, not just mine, who are saying, therefore, that Obama has tried already to unleash 2 major and horrific false flag attacks. Now, again, long before these things supposedly happened, we've talked about them here on Erev Shabbat, among other places. Over just the last few months, all of them were designed to cripple the country physically and financially. The first attempt, he says, was a false flag detonation of multiple nuclear weapons. The claim, in other words, is that there was actually an attempt to detonate some nukes. This failed because the military, some high-level military people, literally refused to go along with it. And several members of the military have now paid for that action with their careers. The entire command structure, if you've heard the numbers, over 200 high-ranking military officers. It's a purge, a coup, unlike anything the military's seen in I don't know when, maybe ever. They've been fired. Again, the entire command structure of the nuclear weapons program has been fired. And for reasons. Remember this one? The use of fake poker chips in a poker game among friends and so forth. Give me a break, he says. Obama's worried about poker chips? You know, there's a big lie going on here. The other one we talked about not long ago was the GRID X2 drill, where a lot of us were saying, hey, be aware, be very aware, expect the possibility of a false flag. He says he and others, he had sources warning about this whole thing, the potential for taking down the power grid. As it turned out, it didn't happen. But the interesting thing is, the intent was there, and it would have happened, these guys claim. Because the second event involved Obama's attempt, and, you know, the military, the New World Order, whoever you want to call it. I'm not comfortable just pointing the finger at one pharaoh. There are a whole bunch of behind-the-scenes puppet masters. Attempting to detonate two high-altitude nukes over mid-continental United States. Now, this is not the first time I've heard this claim being made. It was actually reported. You remember when Lindsey Graham got up and made some absolutely bizarre, astounding statements about if we don't do this stuff, if we don't go to war against Syria, well, they're going to put a nuke in Charleston Harbor. Anyway, the resulting EMP would have crippled the power grid and allowed martial law to be in effect, he says, and so forth and so on. But the military also blocked this false flag event as well. Now, here's the claim. This is interesting. The military has the missing nukes. There were stories about those missing nukes that I saw from multiple sources, reliable ones, prior to this supposedly happening. And now there are stories that the Russians have said, hey, the United States, well, or somebody anyway, did detonate a nuclear device some 500 miles off the coast of South Carolina. So all of this is really interesting. And, you know, again, it's the kind of thing where, like we were talking about with the various plagues in Mitzrayim, hey, how will we know when Yahweh started the plagues and he's made a distinction? Have they started already? Well, there's a lot of interesting stuff going on, and truth is, we simply cannot trust the news. You certainly can't trust TSA to keep you safe when they're groping your four-year-old daughter, or putting you in a microwave oven, or claiming that, you know, hey, we have to do all this stuff because, well, somebody, like us, might push another false flag terror event. Yeah, you know, so many things, in other words, that just stink to high heaven. So he asked this question, and I'm going to throw it out as we wrap it up tonight. Is there a third false flag event planned? Answer, you betcha. There's a third, a fourth, and a fifth. And he believes, according to his sources, that they have to do with earthquakes and other weather events, which are going to be blamed on man-made global climate change, but we already know that's bogus, and probably an electromagnetic event as well. He talks about it in some detail. I won't go through all of those, but basically says one of the places that they may begin. Now listen to this. Pray about it. I'm not saying it will happen. I'm just saying that there are sources that have been reliable in the past that are saying this is something that may happen in the future. That there are, in fact, earthquake devices, old earthquake weapons that have been known for several decades, and that they may have, in fact, been tested in places like Malaysia and Haiti and then in Chile. There was a lot of loss of life and some major quakes in those places. Anyway, the claim here is that the sources have said that there will be an earthquake, a man-made earthquake, set off at the southern end of the New Madrid Fault. Where's the southern end of the New Madrid Fault? Well, the New Madrid Fault, some of you know, runs through down the Mississippi Valley, south of the Boot Heel of Missouri and all the way to the Gulf of Mexico. As I documented, says Hodges this past week, the New Madrid tectonic plates are connected to plates on the floor of the Gulf of Mexico. And if there's a major earthquake, then that will take place in the Gulf, and it will create a tsunami, he believes, and the sources believe, which would devastate the Gulf Coast. So I'm not saying be afraid, be very afraid. I'm just saying be aware. If you have people, and we certainly do, I do, that live in places along the Gulf Coast and the southern part of Louisiana along the Mississippi Delta, pray for them. If it was my family, and some of them are, my prayer is that they'll get out of there for a whole bunch of reasons, that being among them. But be aware of this, and just understand that, again, we don't know what the real story is here, but when I look out and I see all the things that are happening, I do think we're getting to that place where it's difficult anymore to say, well, what's man-made and what's Yah-made? Because certainly the magicians are out there doing their own evil and making their own frogs one way or the other, if you will. By the way, strike two, strike three. There is another event being planned, evidently, across the Atlantic. Some of you know about the Canary Islands and a huge slab that sits over the water that, if that slab was to have an earthquake and fall into the Atlantic Ocean, could cause an incredible tsunami, which would literally travel 1,000 miles across the Atlantic Ocean and would devastate the east coast of the U.S. And, of course, they'll blame that on climate change. And finally, they're saying expect that something may very well exacerbate the situation in Fukushima. Is all of this true? I don't know. Again, and I don't know that we will, not until until later. But when you look at so many of the things that are going on, and I want to, I guess I'll close with, you know, the usual reminders too. We're told by our Father, our Creator, our King, Redeemer, you know, fill in the blanks. Know the times, know the seasons. The men of Issachar did. They knew what should be done, what Israel should do. We should do the same thing. We should be aware of certain things. We should be in prayer. We should be lifting one another up in prayer, talking to our families. I know sometimes we got family members, why are you bothering with all that old Jewish stuff? That's all done away with anyway, say the evangelists. Well, you know what, folks? People's lives are going to depend on whether or not they're willing to obey the Creator of the universe and eat what is food and not eat what's not food. Jeff and I had a discussion this morning on the Drive Time Friday show. So many people have this fatalistic attitude. Well, I'm going to be beamed up. I don't have to worry about any of that. I'll be beamed up out of here. Well, hey, things are getting ugly. You haven't been beamed up yet. Are you starting to get the message? Well, in that case, there's just nothing I can do. I guess I'm just going to die. Well, you know, that fatalistic attitude almost sounds like a prophecy, doesn't it? But on the other hand, there is something you can do about it. For crying out loud, all you got to do is at least begin to walk in obedience to Him. Can't you read what He says? Pork is not food. It was not made to be food. It was made to be a garbage collection system. Don't eat it. Don't eat shellfish. Don't eat anything, for that matter, that comes out of the Pacific. And as for me in my house, I'm not going to eat genetically modified frankenfoods either. That sounds like a prohibited mixture, at least to me, enough to say I don't want to do it. You put all these things together, and you can begin to see, well, whether He makes a distinction or we make a distinction, it's time for us to start making the distinction and separating ourselves. So that remains my comment and I guess my prayer for everybody, that we have eyes to see and ears to hear, and then we begin to separate ourselves and pay attention. Watch, try to know the seasons, because He has declared His intentions through His servants. And I don't know how long we've got, but certainly things are coming to a head.